Welcome to Below the Line, where we talk about working in Hollywood from the crew perspective. My name is Skid. I'm a former assistant director and your host. This episode kicks off season 19 of the podcast. And even though we just wrapped a season of 12 episodes focused on the Academy Awards nominees, we're not quite done with the Oscars. Today, we're talking about Oppenheimer. And my guest is the property master, Guillaume Delouche. Guillaume, welcome to Below the Line.
Good morning.
Nice to see you. I've been really excited about this episode.
Nice to see you too.
Now, a warning for listeners, today's conversation will contain spoilers. Last weekend, Oppenheimer cleaned up at the Oscars. It was nominated in 13 categories and went home with 7 statues. Now, prop mastering is not a recognized category, and even though Oppenheimer was among Below the Line's hypothetical nominees, you should check out episode 12 of the last season. Guillaume did not attend the ceremony. Have you ever attended, Guillaume?
I have not. I never have, actually.
I haven't attended either. So
I worked as a set dresser for Politically Incorrect years and years ago, and it was during the Oscars, so we did something with the after party. That's about
that's as close as you've gotten. Well, it's a fantasy for I think probably anyone that's ever worked film on some level. That being said, for today, we are going to discuss how props contributed to all those other categories. But first, let's talk about how we know each other. We met a long time ago, back when I was an AD trainee. And we were together on Swordfish.
That's right. Yeah, 2000.
I almost wish you hadn't said the year. That was a long time ago. At the time, you were assistant prop master. Talk to me a little bit about your career from then to now.
Yeah, at the time I was working for property master Douglas Harlocker. And we were working on a film directed by Dominic Senna called Swordfish. And you were working for my good friend Mark Cotone, the first AD. It's the film where I met you and Mark, actually. One of my favorite times on set was this picture. We had a blast on that, making this movie. It was a really fun cast, fun crew, all around fun project to be on.
You know, we're going to treat that as a teaser. Let's get together some folks and revisit Swordfish. I think that'll make for a fun podcast.
Sounds great.
But for today, all right, let's turn to our Oscars. What I'm going to do is run through the various categories where Oppenheimer either won or was nominated. And let's talk about props' role in that space and kind of see what stories come of it. Let's start with the movie's win for Best Director. Talk to me about working with Christopher Nolan.
Well, it's definitely intimidating. It's my first time working with Chris Nolan. And, you know, a lot of my peers and colleagues have worked with Chris as prop masters and assistants and so forth. It was a very pleasant surprise. You expect a lot of things, but the obvious things is that he's extremely meticulous and detail-oriented and very hardworking. He's the first person on the set, literally, and the last one to leave. There's a very old school quality to working with him. I think the first big film I did where I was invited to watch dailies was The Truman Show in the mid-90s. And then this is kind of a thing, the dailies, usually they send them to you on your laptop and you log on at night. But this film, we went to a trailer like back in the day and watched the dailies every day on film. And that was really wonderful. Chris is omnipresent during the pre-production. We were a few doors apart in the production office, so you have access to him. He's very accessible to all of his crew, all of his department head. Like I said, he's extremely meticulous, and it shows in the scripts he writes and everything he endeavors to do during pre-production. And there's a sense, there's also a really great sense of a kind of a family atmosphere. A lot of the people that work with Chris Nolan are longtime collaborators. I knew a few of them from various different films, so I wasn't a complete outsider, but it was my first time working with Chris and Emma. And it was one of the best experiences of my career professionally. They create an environment that is just awesome to do good work. It's hard. It's a lot of work, but but it's nonetheless, it's a really great experience.
And I understand it's not just in terms of tone, but there's some practical things, right? Like there's no video village, there's no phones. It's almost a little bit mythic, this talk about how he runs a set.
Right. It's very traditional. And the video village thing started, you know, in the late 80s, early 90s, I think. And I've always more or less had one. Some directors, Michael Bay, among others, also doesn't like to have a big group of people on set, which I understand. And Chris really doesn't. It's really just practical. We move very fast. Chris gives the tempo. And so we move fast. So, yeah, there's not a lot of digital things. And I think it's for the better. The few of us who are allowed to use digital devices are for continuity pictures like hair, makeup, costume, props, on-set dresser. And it's great. It's a return to kind of how we did things, 20, 30 years ago. Or beyond that, when I started in the film business, doing work in the props specifically in the art department generally, I mean, we carried big, clunky Polaroid cameras for continuity photos. And when in pre-production, we took photos of things to show the bosses with film cameras. We would go to the 30-minute moto photo in Culver City to get them processed. you went to Natalie Tai, well, they waited for the photos to be developed, and then you took them back to show and tell. So that's the kind of thing, and it works flawlessly for this system and this group and this director, and it keeps you very focused on what you're doing, on your job. You're very efficient, and it keeps our days very reasonable length. I don't recall we've ever went beyond 12 hours ever, not once on Oppenheimer, on a very tight schedule for a film of that scope.
Is it just the deliberateness? Is it just by force of will? Again, how do you manage to keep those short days?
I think it's experience. I think, Chris and Emma have managed films of any size, from his following all the way to The Dark Knight and et cetera. I think they're really good at what they do, and they've tried everything. They've listened to everyone, and they've selected what works best for them. And that's the formula that works best. And honestly, it works best for me too. It was a very pleasant professional experience through and through, because the days were reasonable and the atmosphere on set was very civilized, very polite, and you were able to make your day almost every day.
Well, I want to talk more about what happened on set, but before we get there, recognizing that it wasn't a win, but Oppenheimer was nominated for adapted screenplay. And I'm curious about how you work with the script. I know he keeps his scripts very secret. They're not available ahead of time. Very few people can read them. What does that mean for you as the property master on one of his films?
Well, yes, and they're not the only ones to do that. Many times when you first get hired to work on a project, you're not allowed to take the script home, or you're not allowed to. I mean, before the era of computers and apps, et cetera, I remember we would go read I think it was the Godzilla script in 97. It was a red script, and you had to go read it in an office with the security at the door, that sort of thing. You're allowed to take notes. And it's the same thing with this one. And it just ensures that no one inadvertently shares this, obviously, in an email, and it gets leaked, because it would have dire consequences for the picture, obviously, in this era of everything being shared everywhere all the time. For me, the script is obviously extremely important. And so I, as a prop master, much like as a set decorator or any other department head, I have access to the script every day under controlled circumstances. But I'm very analog, much like Chris. I still write my notes with a fountain pen. So I can't really get used to all the typing. But for me, I've done the same process for the last 30 years, which is just read the script and then take notes and break it down by scene and write down all the props you need per scene and have a list of questions for the director. So the scene, obviously the script is super important, and we can't do it without. But I don't necessarily mind not having it in my possession at all times. I think it's confined to the office hours, the work hours. It's perfectly fine. And it keeps the project secure and also gives the project a little bit more mystique, as you said earlier.
Moving us kind of through pre-production, a little closer to what's happening on set, recognizing that Oppenheimer had wins for Best Leading Actor, Cillian Murphy, Best Supporting Actor, Robert Downey Jr., and also had a nomination for Best Supporting Actress with Emily Blunt. Talk to me about the role that props plays in creating these characters.
Props is typically associated with the art department, which is true. We work very closely with the set decoration, art, the production designer, construction crew, etc. But we also, one of our closer collaborators is costumes, because we accessorize the cast. So with Chris Nolan and Emma, the way they conduct pre-production with fittings with actors is actually really smart again. And they are present at every fitting for every one of our cast members. We do them every day throughout pre-production. And we had a cast of 90 plus people. So it was literally a daily affair. And we would show up with my assistant, Rachel Nowick, and I would show up with trays of watches and eyewear and rings and pipes and cigarette cases and pens, etc., to give the actors things to have in their pockets and play with. And we had done research of every historical character that's depicted in our film. We, for every one of them, we had a packet hanging on our wall. So we had about 90 packets of everything we could find for. So if Fermi wore glasses, or did he smoke, or, you know, how many cigarettes did Oppie smoke every day, et cetera, et cetera. So we work closely with the actors and with the director, obviously, and with the historical facts. Now, there was a moment, our very first fitting with Robert Downey Jr. for the character of Admiral Strauss, where we saw him, and he had just had his hair done a little bit for the character. And Ellen Mirojnik, our wonderful costume designer, put him in the wardrobe. And then I found the glasses that Admiral Strauss wore in real life are still made today by the same company. So we reached out to them. We got a couple of replicas of the exact model. And then we also by pure chance found the watch that he wore at one of the hearings. So we put the watch, the ring, the glasses, and we put the glasses on, and with the costume and the hair and makeup. And this is Louis Strauss is a character, a real person that I've been, whose picture I've been on my wall for at that point 2 months, and I've been looking at him and every day. And then he came to life. I mean, it was no Robert Downey Jr., who's one of the biggest movie stars on the planet. If you see him, you're completely gone. And I'm not jaded. I've been doing this for a long time, a lot of movies, and worked with a lot of really wonderful actors. But this was one of the first times where I really realized the power of all this put together. And we all almost gasped, like, wow, this is Strauss. So that was one of the very interesting moment for me to see that this far into my career to realize that again.
Is there more you want to say about working with these actors particularly?
Yeah, I mean, I'll tell you too, obviously our other two main actors, Cillian Murphy and Emily Blunt, aside from being really, really nice to work with, very pleasant, very professional. I feel bad for Cillian, because we had to smoke a lot, and I think we manufactured over 10,000 of those fake Chesterfields, and so we used a blend of menthol flavored herbal cigarettes, completely tobacco and nicotine free. And then we had them handmade and stamped with the Chesterfield stamp. And Oppenheimer smoked, I believe it was like 100 cigarettes a day. And then when he wanted to take a break from smoking, he smoked a pipe. So we also had a complete panoply of pipes that we would fill with herbal tobacco for Cillian. So for a guy who never smoked, it was pretty rough for him. And, you know, I was right there with him, because I had to light the pipe for him. And Emily was also just a wonderful actor to work with a very, very tough role, a very tragic character, which, you know, we worked with her a little bit on certain things. There was a funny moment where she smashes a bottle, and I'm supposed to catch it off camera, and it was a strong moment, but she unfortunately, I missed the bottle. She didn't miss me, though, so that made for some fun times on set. But,
oh, no.
But that's a little funny anecdote we had on set.
Well, speaking of on set, you mentioned earlier working with costumes and then how the hair and makeup came together in designing the characters. Oppenheimer didn't win, but was nominated for both costume design and makeup and hairstyling. Talk to me a little bit more about working with those departments through the shooting schedule.
Yeah, well, with costumes, we always collaborate with costumes for a number of things. If there are any type of military or police uniforms in a film, obviously we have to complement them with military and police accoutrements. We do watch in the United States, we provide watches and eyewear. In the UK, typically, it's the costumes does that. We do some jewelry as well for men. In this particular case, we help fabricate certain pieces for costumes because of our prop shop. And then also, you know, while we're on set, there's an element of continuity with the actor's appearance. So there's always a strong collaboration between the set costumers and the set prop people. So we always work well with them. Makeup is a little bit more, it's a little bit more subtle. Sometimes we work with the makeup or special effects makeup department. On this film, we really didn't collaborate with them, but we saw them at work and the work was breathtaking. What they did with the aging process and the transformations of actors into real historical characters. So I thought the nominations were very well deserved personally for both these departments.
Two other departments that were recognized. The movie got a win for cinematography and a nomination for sound.
Yeah, well, cinematography was the film was made entirely on 70 millimeter IMAX and 65 millimeter, and this was quite a feat. These cameras were very loud. So the sound department also had a little bit of a tough time. I mean, the 65 millimeter was blimped, so it wasn't loud, but the 70 millimeter IMAX cameras were. And it was interesting, you know, it's Chris doesn't do a whole lot of takes. You know, it's pretty precise. I mean, he does the takes that he needs and that the cast needs. And we had very long scenes with a lot of dialogue and a lot of things that people were doing, whether it was physics experiments or testing explosives or being in a hearing with a lot of paperwork and such. So we don't really work that closely with sound. Sometimes we'll help them hide a microphone inside something. That's the kind of set logistics we work with. With camera, it depends on the film as well. On a more modern film, I may work with them with, you know, body cams on a police officer, that sort of thing. On this picture, you know, we were just trying not to get in their way. It was just really, really great to see Hoyta and his team work with these giant cameras and accomplish the things they were accomplishing with them. It was just, once you see the result on screen, obviously it's beautiful, but it was interesting and challenging at the same time to work with these big cameras, these big IMAX cameras at the source.
Well, and an area where the film did not get nominated was visual effects.
Yeah, my personal humble opinion, I was shocked. I was really surprised at first because we worked very, very closely with Scott Fisher, our special effects coordinator. His prop shop fabricated the gadget, the bomb, and a few other props. I like to work with the special effects prop shop because historically that's how the prop shop works. The prop master has a prop shop that manufactures the props in-house. And in this picture, it was kind of essential for us to do that. Now, Scott Fisher also worked with the visual effects coordinator to create all of the in-camera special effects that are in the film, the explosion, etc. were all real elements, and all of the things you see on screen during the physics experiments and the depiction of the atoms and everything, that there's no CGI. So I was intrigued why they weren't nominated for visual effects, because these are very visual effects and they were not made with the aid of a computer or AI or anything like that. So it was a lot of work for them. They worked for weeks on end using aquariums and magnets and a lot of other magic stuff that they did with to get these effects in camera, and it was very impressive to see made as well.
Another win for Oppenheimer was in film editing.
We don't work closely with the editor, but the editor works closely with us. I make a mistake sometimes, the editing will take it out, and I'm very lucky and I thank them for all their help. And sometimes even if I don't make a mistake, sometimes they might pick a take that's better for a lot of other reasons that are more important than the prop's continuity. And it will appear on screen as though there is a continuity error, either from props or from costumes or from set dressing. Whereas we try to take to take, but since we don't always film the picture in sequence, you have to go back and forth. So that's about the extent of our work with the editor. But we obviously the Jennifer Lame did a beautiful job of this picture, and I'm very, very, very proud and humbled to work with such a talented group of people.
Yeah, and it sounds like that. Yeah, if you make a mess of the props, you're really going to put that editor in a jam.
But there were a lot of. We filmed a lot of inserts of props, which you see in all of the teaser trailers had, obviously, the bomb, the close-ups of the gadget, and the close-ups of the little timer we manufactured, and the Nixie clock, and the push button to start the timer, and the switches, etc. So, it's always flattering when you work on a picture and you go to the movies with your family and you see the trailer for your next picture and there's a close-up of your bomb or a close-up of a gadget you made. So in that sense, it was great to see that they really used a lot of those beautiful inserts and close-ups of our work to showcase it for the film. It's very hard to detach yourself from something and appreciate it when you looked at it naked and in pieces on your work table for weeks. But when you see the finished product and with all of the things that went into it, it's also extremely flattering and it feels very good.
Now, Guillaume, this might be a stretch, but tell me how props contributes to Oppenheimer's win for original score.
I don't know Mr. Ludwig Göransson personally. I'm a very big fan of his work. I think every one of his scores is just incredible, and I was just thrilled to where I'm a very big fan of movie soundtracks. I have a lot of them in my iTunes. Maybe we inspired a tiny little thing for a score. If that's all I did, I'll be very happy.
That was an amazing score. We might just have to give him that one. I'm not sure we can claim a piece of that one, but yeah, he did great work on that. Well deserved. Next, I want to talk about Oppenheimer's nomination for production design. And as you mentioned earlier, props, you work very closely with the art department. Talk to me about your relationship and your contributions in this area, in this part of the film.
Well, on this picture, I was approached to work on it by Ruth DeYoung, our production designer. And so she's the production designer, is the boss, the head of the art department. She's in charge of the entire look of the whole picture. So once Ruth and Chris Nolan hired me, I started working with her and with her researcher, Lauren Sandoval, who acquired literally tons of research and knowledge on our movie. We had the book by Kai Bird, American Prometheus, to go by, and obviously Chris's script. And then from then, we worked very closely with Claire Kaufman as well, our Academy Award nominated set decorator, to layer the set. Essentially, the art department builds the sets, the set decorator dresses the set, and then we come in and we'll add, if there's a side table, we'll add the house keys and Oppenheimer's wallet. And in his wallet will be his driver's license for the right period, et cetera, et cetera. So we worked very closely with them on a lot of these details. Early on, Ruth and I started working on the gadget with Scott Fisher. We hired Justin Miller, who's a concept illustrator, to deconstruct the gadget and make it into a 3D file that could then be output by a prop shop. And we built the core of it, as well as the a version that could be hoisted in the tower, and then a version that could have all of the little detonators added by hand on camera. So a lot of times when there's a very big or what we call a hero prop, obviously the production designer, since it's a big part of the film, the production designer is very much involved in the creation and design and concept of this. And so I will work with them. They will work with us on creating this from beginning to end. As with the set decorator, you know, if you do a big banquet scene, we'll provide the food, they'll provide the finery for it. Claire and I worked very hard to get the train scenes right. We had so many train scenes with so many food scenes and dinners and lunches in the train, among other great sets she did. But those were logistically tough to get. It's hard to get a kitchen, a full kitchen going to feed actors on camera in a train from the 40s. But we did it, and thanks to Claire and her team, we were able to achieve that.
Now, in being nominated for production design, and also in the areas where we talked about earlier with nominations for costume design and makeup and hairstyling, it was Poor Things that took the awards home in these design areas. When we did our hypothetical nominations for prop mastering, obviously, as I mentioned earlier, we nominated Oppenheimer. We also nominated Poor Things. And I'm just a little curious, again, in this hypothetical Oscar race between these movies, what do you think it is about Poor Things that caught people's imagination? Or do you think there's something about the props work on Oppenheimer that, you know, given a bake-off, what kind of matchup would have that been?
Well, I think that usually, maybe historically, again, I don't really follow this that much, but I think there's an element of fantasy that didn't exist in a historical film. In a historical film, you follow what history tells you to follow. So perhaps that's the edge that Poor Thing would have over a historical picture. I'm not a member of the Academy. I'm not, my profession is not part of the design branch that's recognized for an achievement for an Academy Award. So I'm not an expert at this and I don't vote. But that to me, that's kind of how it was explained to me and how I would justify it, I guess.
Well, what Oppenheimer did win for was Best Picture. Give me a sense of what that means to everyone who worked on the film and obviously to props specifically.
So on a personal level, it typifies and it really illustrates, actually, it's a perfect metaphor for what Chris Nolan and Emma Thompson are able to achieve on a day-to-day basis filming a movie on their set. It's Best Picture is basically the recognition that everything came together to create a perfect product. I'm sorry to use the term product for this film, but... and it's what this is exactly the atmosphere that Chris and Emma bring to set. It's a very family-oriented atmosphere, an atmosphere of hard work and trying to get perfection and concentration. Chris and Emma really give everybody the tools to be the best at what they do. And I think, so to me, this was, I felt it was a very well-deserved recognition of this, of all their work. And it's just not me saying this. I've only worked with them once. Everyone that's worked with them repeatedly will say the same thing, that they create a very good atmosphere on set, and they're very hardworking, and they're very loyal to their crews. So I think that was kind of the recognition of that.
I was struck during the ceremony. Did you actually watch the ceremony, Guillaume?
I even did. Though
we didn't get to attend, but that when...
Yeah, I'm not mad at all that I'm not... I still think it's a great show to watch.
When they announced Best Picture, the entire crew comes up, but Christopher Nolan, or Chris Nolan, as now I'm calling him since you're calling him that, he gave the spotlight to Emma Thomas and Charles Roven and let them speak and didn't take the opportunity to sort of, I don't know, imprint himself as the last speaker of the night, which I thought was fascinating. You talk about how omnipresent he is during prep and on set and sort of how influential he is and how it runs. And yet he allowed himself to sink into the background in a way that I was struck by and seems to me to sort of capture that idea of this family atmosphere you're talking about.
Yes, I think that, Chris had won his director Oscar. And I think it was now time to share the spotlight with Emma and Chuck, our producers. And that's, you know, I think Chris is also a very humble person. He's not a flashy person. He's a hard worker. He's a worker. And I think it shows again in his it's a very classy way to do this. It was also Emma and Chuck's Oscar. So it was a great, great time for them to give their speech and be recognized.
Well, again, while they're not giving out statues to everybody involved with the production, I don't know. I'm hoping that you feel a bit like it's props Oscar as well. Certainly props was a huge role in this one, besides it being a lot of work. But again, how all of it came together is very impressive.
No, thank you. It was on a film like this, there's a big effort. I was also very fortunate I was able to hire a lot of very talented people. Four of my staff were actual prop masters who worked on this alongside me. We had one in New Mexico, two in LA, and then one in New York. We came on board to do this film with their crews. So we had a lot of very talented people to do this. We were able to have the shop, the special effects shop run by Scott Fisher, to build our props. It's a team effort. It was a fairly short prep for a film of that size, but it was a long effort for everyone to get it to the finish. And it was challenging at times, but I was blessed with a group of very talented, hardworking people working right alongside me. So it was again, an overall great experience.
You know, we structured our conversation around the Oscars just a week after. Listeners, if you want to learn more about the work that Props did behind the scenes on this, I want to give a shout out to another podcast called Prop Talk. Guillaume and some members of his team recorded at the 2023 LA Comic Con. That episode was released on December 26th. Guillaume, anything else about that experience or about Prop Talk you want to give a shout out to?
Yeah, I was. Prop Talk is the brainchild of members of the Property Masters Guild. And I think it's a bi-weekly podcast that you can find on the PMG website, pmg.org website. The Comic-Con panel was my first time at any Comic-Con, and I was really surprised at the level of dedication of the fans. I had no idea that people were this passionate about this, and it was very refreshing. I took my eldest daughter with me to come to this, because she's more in that world than I would be. And it was really, really great to see. And we filled the room actually with Oppenheimer. And I was also, you know, we have people dressed up like Star Wars characters and manga and so forth. And they're coming in to see us talk about a 3-hour film about a physicist. And they were really passionate and they asked a lot of questions. It was very, it was really flattering to be part of this. I was very honored to be able to do that and answer questions. Really great experience.
Well, Gail, I'm honored to have had you on this show as well. We're going to get you back to do that swordfish conversation at one point, but for today, we'll call it a wrap. So great seeing you.
Thank you, Robert. Always nice. Actually, I called you Skid many times before. So it's been 20, maybe a couple of decades, but I can still call you Skid.
My Robert persona and Skid persona getting a little blurry. Listeners, I always appreciate your feedback, whether directed to Skid or Robert. You'll find my contact info at our website, belowtheline1word.biz. That's BIZ. You'll also find past episodes and links to all of our social media, so check it out. Guillaume, where are we going to see your work next?
We have a picture that should be coming out soon. We have two pictures, actually, that should be coming out soon. One is called Night Bitch. And it stars Amy Adams, and it's going to be a great film. And I can't say much more about it.
Okay.
And then the other one is called Wolves. It's a picture directed by John Watts, starring Brad Pitt and George Clooney. And that's also going to be really, really great. And I can't say much about it either, but I highly recommend both. We had a blast making both these films. And so that's coming up in the next few months this year.
Wow, okay, well, we'll watch for both of those. Closing credits, thanks to Curtis Five for our music, John Wan for our logo, and to all our listeners, I appreciate you. Please rate us wherever you get your podcasts and tell your friends. Thanks again from Below the Line.